From the Arizona Daily Star and Tucson.com, this is the Wildcast.
Hi, everybody. Ryan Finley here. The following podcast deals with our ongoing series, Tidal Wave. To read every story in the series, visit Tucson.com. If you're interested in following further Title IX issues, follow the Star's Caitlin Schmidt on Twitter. She is at Caitlin C. Schmidt. You can email her at cschmidt@tucson.com. On with the show. Welcome to the Tidal Wave podcast. This is episode 3. I'm Arizona Daily Star sports editor Ryan Finley, here with reporter Caitlin Schmidt. If you have not read our series, please pause the podcast right now. Go to tucson.com and read our Tidal Wave series, then come back. We'll be waiting for you, I promise. Caitlin Schmidt joins us. Today, we're talking about the University of Oregon. To me, Caitlin, the universe of all the schools that we've profiled and that we've talked to in this project, to me, the University of Oregon seems much more on par with the U of A. In episode 2, we talked at length about Baylor. Baylor is kind of the new standard, I think, for Title IX policies and procedures. But let's be honest, Baylor is a Baptist private institution that spent $4.5 million to revamp its Title IX program. I'm not necessarily sure that's scalable at schools like the University of Arizona, but some of the things that Oregon has done, I think, is really different and interesting. Take me through sort of, you know, where, what the tipping point was and how we got to this point.
I guess the tipping point was the 2014 incident involving several basketball players accused of...
Right. Brandon Austin, Damian Dotson, and Dominic Artis.
Yes. There was a gang rape allegation in there. Some question of why they were allowed to play in games when the school knew about what was going on. But that was kind of the tipping point for the school that set off a... Student Senate Review Board, Faculty Review Board. I mean, the school just really started looking at it. I believe there was a President's Task Force to evaluate how this had kind of been allowed to happen.
Right. Oregon was initially under some big-time scrutiny because they allowed these players to continue to play. Austin, I believe, had faced similar charges when he was at Providence before he transferred to Oregon. And so there was a belief when this initial, I think it was like a 24-page police report, came out, there was a belief that Oregon had sort of let somebody with a history of this on campus and then basically allowed them to continue playing basketball while they investigated this new allegation. I remember at least sitting in Tucson, Arizona, as it being generally an embarrassing moment for that basketball program and athletic department and a very serious matter that people maybe thought Oregon didn't take seriously enough at the time.
Yeah, and that's when I was speaking to their Title IX director, Darcy Heroy. She had said essentially the same thing. That was the big tipping point, you know, President's Review Panel, Senate Faculty Review, Task Force to examine this, and all of these big changes came out of it, notably a new revamped Title IX policy, which it seems is the first step for all of these schools.
Sure.
But one of the things that they wanted to do was make sure that outreach was the first thing made available to these students. So when you file a Title IX complaint, the first person that you're going to hear from is somebody that is a confidential source that doesn't have to share with anybody who's in the position to make disciplinary decisions. So Darcy told me a little bit about that when I talked to her on the phone in late January.
Part of the structure that I helped sort of oversee putting in place was making sure that when we got reports from students, any student who was affected by sexual harassment, sex or gender-based discrimination, sexual violence, all of those reports from students or disclosures from students, we get outreach from one of our confidential staff first, which was sort of a way at the time of working with the existing kind of blanket reporting policy that a lot of institutions had. And I wanted to make sure that students had as much agency as possible when they were disclosing information to help also encourage people to report, because there's always a fear about being forced into some kind of a conduct process or investigation if you don't want that. And so we set up this process of having the confidential staff reach out first and be that first sort of point of contact to then talk with students confidentially about their options. And I think that really helped encourage reports to start coming in more.
See, and Caitlin, that's interesting because at a lot of universities, including like the U of A, certain people, most faculty and staff, in fact, are mandatory reporters, correct?
Yes.
So that if you sat down and said, this has happened to me. That person is required to turn around and go to the Title IX office, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In this case at Oregon, that's not what happens now.
Right. No. The person who you hear back from is going to offer you resources, see where you want to go with it before any kind of formal process is started. And that's sort of what's so unique about them is that they did away with this blanket mandatory reporting policy.
But to me, it's counterintuitive, though, right? Is we'll get more reports or better reports if we stop telling people to report. What's their rationale there?
Very interesting. I also spoke to a psychologist on staff, Jennifer Fried, who has been doing this research since 1987 with Oregon, I believe. She's employed there since 87, started before. Mm-hmm. And she had found that there actually can be some harm to the victim when you make everybody a mandatory reporter. So let's see what she had to say.
Mandatory reporting policies like that have been very controversial in certain circles. And what I have... I got very involved in this issue now 3 or 4 years ago because I was very concerned that these policies were actually counterproductive, both in the sense of actually having the effect of chilling reporting and having the side effect, you might say, but a really big one, of harming survivors who either lose the option to talk to somebody they trust or lose the option to control their own narrative.
So basically her point here is rather than tell somebody, right, if you're a mandatory, if you have a staff full of mandatory reporters, oftentimes a victim won't come in and say anything, right, for fear of knowing that it's going to go up that chain as soon as they say something?
Yeah, they'll lose control of their narrative.
Okay, am I oversimplifying?
No, really not. This is what I mean, and Dr. Frey did a lot of research in this in the field of behavioral science that found that this can hurt the victims because at this point in their life, probably what they need more than anything is to regain some sense of control. And by telling their story and having no control of what happens after they tell it, that, I mean, that can be just as damaging as anything else.
Well, and it's funny. It's one of those things, like Baylor had said the same thing, correct? Is most of the people who report, or I'm sorry, most of the people who come in to discuss what has happened, most of them just want support services.
Yes. Yes.
Right. They have not called the police. No criminal investigation has been opened. Most of the people who come in and say that this happened want basically, medical or mental health or
administrative class schedule.
Right. Support. Right. Yeah. More so than, I want to make sure that the person who did this to me gets kicked out of school or disciplined or whatever it would be.
Right. And Darcy at Oregon had told me that actually only about 10% of the total number of complaints that they get, students want some kind of formal investigation process from that. The overwhelming majority just need help in some other way. So, I mean, it took some give and take. Dr. Freid had a hard time, she said, convincing administration that eliminating mandatory reporters was the way to go. But in the end, they did it. It's been in place for about a year and a half. And so they have 3 different groups of reporting parties. So you have confidential employees, and they're confidential in a legal capacity. So it's, doctors at campus health, counselors, psychologists, people who have a legal obligation to keep what you're saying private. The second bucket is going to be designated reporters. Those will be like people in the Title IX office or in the dean of students or administrative positions, people who can take action.
Sure.
And then the third group is what they call student-directed, and Darcy explained that much better than I can, so let's hear it from her.
In the biggest bucket, this is different from other institutions. We didn't make people have no obligation to report. What we did was create a category called student-directed, and so that's the biggest group of employees, and they are obligated to do what the student wants them to do. So if a student comes to a faculty, for example, and discloses that they've experienced violence or harassment, and again, this is just in the Title IX context, but then that faculty needs to ask them, if they want to make a more formal report to the institution to have some kind of, more formal intervention, or if they are wanting to keep that information more private but instead be connected with resources and support. And then that employee or faculty would have to consult with our confidential staff at the crisis intervention office. So they may not share a name or anything of the student, but they would be focused on connecting that student with support and resources and information about their options.
So basically, this group of people, Caitlin, can offer or can send somebody who says they've been sexually assaulted, can send them to resources or can put them in touch with others in this without being obligated to report. Correct?
Yes. I mean, and they do some tracking. So the student's name won't be recorded, but of course, for tracking purposes, they need to keep track of these disclosures so that they can see where they go and how that happens. But I mean, everything is confidential until the student has decided what to do with it. And another interesting different thing about Oregon was that Darcy was very committed. Instead of calling them reports or complaints, she makes a distinction between complaints and disclosures.
We put together numbers every year on the number of disclosures that we get. And I say disclosures because people disclose things all the time, and it's not the same, in my view, as someone actually making a report to try and get some kind of intervention. And so I distinguish usually between disclosures and actual reports that we get. Because, for example, we can get disclosures like third hand, right? So someone who's not intending to report to us, but somebody else shares the information with us on their behalf, or if they don't know about it. So I try to be aware of those differences. But we run those numbers every year to look at how many in total disclosures we had, how many of those maybe resulted in an alternative resolution or an informal process, how many of those went to a formal investigation or student conduct process. We had a significant increase in the first couple of years after we really started facilitating some of these changes. And I think it's probably stabilized in the last couple of years. It's still a sort of steady increase, but it's not as drastic as it was before, which I think is probably expected. We continue to have really high rates of reports, which is actually a good thing, you know, high rates of disclosures. I always am more concerned about institutions that I see where they have really low numbers, because we know stuff is still happening, so I would prefer that these things are shared and students are actually contacting us for help.
So, I mean, it makes sense if you think about it, when the majority of the people coming in aren't actually wanting a formal investigation,
right,
they're disclosing. So this allows them to, you know, keep track of how many people are going through the formal process, how many people just want counseling, how
right,
many people need no contact orders. But it's a distinction that I hadn't heard from anybody in any other schools yet.
Mm-hmm. What happens at Oregon if a criminal investigation is underway?
You know, they'll be parallel
okay,
investigations. The student would have, of course, had to initiate that criminal investigation on their own. They have memo of understandings with
okay,
local law enforcement, but they don't report to
okay,
law enforcement. So, I mean, it's a unique situation. You would think that if the student had reported to police that they probably would be willing to go through a Title IX investigation, but of
right,
course they don't have to. If they wanted to let the police handle that on the criminal side and then just come to the school for counseling or a change in dorm or whatever, certainly that's their option too.
Wow.
But the school will not launch a formal investigation without the student okaying it.
Right. And now that's similar, and I'm hesitant to draw comparisons because this is apples and oranges, right? But something like at the U of A is student-directed, correct?
Yes.
All Title IX complaints. What is the difference between student-directed and what we're talking about at Oregon?
Well, so Oregon is student. I mean, they're both using the term student-directed,
okay,
and that the student will decide what they want to have happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, of course, certain situations. If a student discloses something
mm-hmm,
that would indicate that the suspect could be a danger to other students,
mm-hmm,
unfortunately, sometimes the school
right,
will have to look into it.
Right.
It would be negligent to not do otherwise. But they really have to have that distinction in order to override a student's wishes, which is similar to what's happening at Baylor, and actually which is similar with what's happening at the U of A. The U of A has also told us that their investigations are student-directed and that they don't take any action without the student's consent.
Mm-hmm.
We've just kind of gotten some conflicting information from past reports and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for all intents and purposes, the U of A is doing the same thing now,
mm-hmm,
but they still have this mandatory reporting group that's different than Oregon. So, I mean, once they make a disclosure at the U of A, once
mm-hmm,
a student makes a disclosure to a faculty member, that member is obligated to take it to the Dean of Students or Title IX
mm-hmm,
who will then contact the student. But from that point, the student gets to decide what to do. So I think the big difference is at Oregon, if the student doesn't want the Dean of Students or Title IX to ever know about it, they won't.
For lack of a better word, I think Oregon, of all of the schools who you've talked to, maybe the most empathetic and most in tune with the victims or the people who make these complaints. It seems like they've come at it with a scholarly background of research shows that people will talk about what happened, but only if there's no real threat of it being initially reported or whatever it would be. To me, this is a really interesting counterpoint to what we see at a lot of other places.
Right. And I think, you know, it was a great benefit for them to have Dr. Freyd already on staff, already an expert in this field.
And she had been outspoken about Oregon's performance in the past when it comes to this, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm. She got in trouble for that. This is a benefit, I guess, of having tenure because she's still employed there. Mm-hmm. But it was really nice to hear from somebody that said, yeah, I saw this problem even before the basketball thing, but nobody wanted to acknowledge it. But she has, you know, one of her areas of expertise is institutional betrayal, otherwise known as when the school doesn't respond the way it should to an allegation of sexual misconduct. So they had, you know, a literal expert on their side in-house working at them. And she said it even took some work to get them to adapt this reporting model. Mm-hmm. But they feel like it's been successful. I mean, the policy isn't the only thing they've done, of course. They've beefed up training. Mm-hmm. Incoming, you know, all incoming students are going to receive Title IX education. They have different programs for athletes, different programs for transfer students and international students. They also do targeted training for specific groups if they recognize needing it. And one of the other interesting things that they have is they have a course specifically designed for students in their first term that teaches them about healthy relationships, consent, bystander intervention, substance abuse. And they had told me that 80% of their first year student athletes are taking that class.
Wow.
Not mandatory, but they're taking it for credit.
Right. Nice. So sort of a colloquium. It's a one credit class or whatever it would be. It counts toward graduation.
Yeah, counts towards graduation. But I mean, nobody's making these kids take it. So 80% right. shows that there's a real interest in learning about these things.
Right. Oregon is certainly doing things. I find probably of all the schools who we talk to me, this is the most interesting because it, just as an outsider, my instinct is, well, there would be more reports if there were more reports, right? If you sat there and said, okay, well now, you know, I mean, let's get the perpetrators off campus. Let's, you know, we'll take it from here, almost like in a law enforcement situation. But here it seems as if by taking the pressure off of the victim to report that actually you're able to get better outcomes.
Right. I mean, and it all goes back to the root of Title IX. Of course you want predators off campus. Of course you want campus to be a safe place. But the whole purpose of Title IX was making sure that everyone had equal opportunity to an education and could graduate school. So this kind of reporting policy really puts that autonomy back on students to decide what's the best way for them to make it through school. And for some, in the wake of a sexual assault, it is not to go through a complete investigation. It's just to get help and finish it off. So it's nice to see a kind of victim-driven approach to a really personal issue.
Absolutely. Caitlin Schmidt, if you have not read her Tidal Wave project, please go to Tucson.com right now and do it. Coming up on episode 4, we will be talking about the University of Utah. They're a place that manages to stay proactive really without any recent scandals of note, and they do it in a very unique way. So please stay tuned with us for episode 4, where we'll be talking about what the University of Utah is doing. For Caitlin Schmidt, I'm Ryan Finley. Thank you for listening to the Tidal Wave podcast. We'll see you next time.
Hi, Wildcaster fans. Come check out The Point Being, the Arizona Daily Star's opinion page podcast. We talk about current events, what's going on in the world, the letters page, and more. So check us out at thepointbeingpodcast.com.